I've said this before because I think it's really obvious. We live in a divided age. We know there are divisions within our country, people against one another. But we also live in a divided age in the sense that a lot of people are internally divided. They feel tensions, or there are tensions in what they believe. I think it's kind of true for a lot of us. We believe some things over here that actually don't line up with other things that we hold to be true. And that's true with people today. On the one hand, people think that often there is no God, right? It's increasingly there are people who are atheists or people who don't really believe in a personal God. And that is kind of the viewpoint that is offered, often hammered home to us through science. Science itself is not a bad discipline by any means. It's not contrary to Christianity by any means. And yet there are some scientists who think, well, we have no need for God. And as one, Carl Sagan, once said, the cosmos, or the universe, is all that is or ever was or ever will be. For him, the universe is just a set of stars, planets, and galaxies, and whatever physical forces operate within them. For a person who has that kind of view, there's just physical objects, physical forces, operating with all the precision and personality of a giant clock. And outside of Disney movies, clocks don't have personalities. Everything in reality, according to this view, could be reduced to molecules, to atoms, whatever fundamental particles there are behind those things. Now, people who have such a view often think, well, you folks, you religious folks, with your God, you have this primitive view of reality, a superstitious view. And some people mock the idea of God, thinking, oh, it's like believing there's Santa Claus or the Tooth Fairy. There are some atheists who in the past couple of decades have mocked the idea of intelligent design, that there's a being who designed and created life. And so they say, well, that's just like believing in a flying spaghetti monster. And they say, oh yes, we have a religion just like yours, just as legitimate as yours. We call it Pastafarianism. It's all a joke. So some people believe, oh, it's just the universe, just physics. It's just science, just math, all the way down. There's no divine being, no personality behind everything. But on the other hand, all of us realize that the most important things to us are deeply personal, like relationships and love, and even morality. What are all the debates that we have today, the political debates? What are they at bottom? They're moral debates about what is right and what is wrong, what the government ought to do or what the government ought not to do. You don't get morality from an impersonal universe, a godless universe. Moral values and obligations, those things are deeply personal. And I think we know better, because the language and the actions of people who claim that they don't believe in a God actually betray the view that behind everything is a personality. And so they use God substitutes. They say, well, you know, the universe is trying to tell me something. The universe doesn't say anything. It's not a person. It's just stuff. It makes about as much sense as saying, well, this morning, my coffee mug was trying to give me a sign. It's give me some direction for today. Now, an impersonal object can speak to us, right? Like a book is just an object, paper glued together with some ink on it. But behind the book is a person who's communicating. It's the way the universe is. We also realize that people are more important than things. There's a Christian philosopher named Gregory Gansley wrote this really nice book called Our Deepest Desires, How the Christian Story Fulfills Human Aspirations. And in it, he's talking about how people matter. And he says about 9/11, the anniversary, 21st anniversary is coming up next week. He says, on that day, no one grieved for the loss of the buildings. He says, the World Trade Center towers were magnificent, beautiful buildings. They were marvels of engineering. But we did not grieve for them. That day we grieved for the people. Nearly 3,000 people died, and we felt the loss of that, not the loss of buildings. Buildings can be replaced. You could create exact replicas of those buildings, but people are irreplaceable. People matter. Relationships matter. Matter? Well, it's just matter. Now, why do I say all this? I'm aware that every time I get up and preach and I speak about the Bible and talk about Jesus, that this whole idea is very foreign to some people in our age. The idea of saying there is a relationship with a person that we've never seen, that we've never touched, that matters more than anything else in our lives. It's every week I'm saying that. What matters most is God and our relationship with Him. And to some people, that's like believing in an imaginary friend. Oh, that's nice for you, makes you feel good, but it's not real. But in the end, if there is no divine person, no God behind everything, everything is just meaningless, and it won't last, and it will all be swallowed up in death. I want to read this kind of longer quote from this famous philosopher, British philosopher, who was also famous for being an atheist, a man named Bertrand Russell, active in the early and middle of the 20th century. It's a long quote, but what he's saying is there are a series of that clauses, and he's basically saying, we know these things to be true. Here it is. He says, that man is the product of causes which had no prevision of the end they were achieving. That man's origin, his growth, his hopes and fears, his loves and his beliefs are but the outcome of accidental collocations of atoms. That no fire, no heroism, no intensity of thought and feeling can preserve an individual life beyond the grave. That all the labors of the ages, all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system, and that the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruins. All these things, if not quite beyond dispute, are yet so nearly certain that no philosophy which rejects them can hope to stand. Only with the scaffolding of these truths, only on the firm foundation of unyielding despair, can the soul's habitation henceforth be safely built. Very wordy, uncommon words being used, but I'll paraphrase what he's saying. He's saying, in this modern view, which we know to be true, any valid philosophy must uphold these things. That we, human beings, are produced by just chance, by accident. There's no personal cause, no God. We're a cosmic accident. And therefore, everything about us, our hopes, our fears, what we love, what we believe, all of that is just a bunch of atoms smashing together. There's nothing that lasts beyond death, no heroism, no powerful feelings, no profound thoughts, no work, no artistic inspiration, no human invention or deeds. Everything is swallowed up in death. The whole temple of man's achievement will come crumbling down in the vast death of the solar system. And he says this is a view of unyielding despair. It's gloomy, it's dark, it's pessimistic, and yet that's the way things are, he says. And it's true. If that's the way things are, there's no reason to have hope. There's no reason to think that anything we do matters. Everything will die. We will die. It will all be forgotten. It will be as if nothing ever existed in the first place. That's one option. That's the way the universe is. But the other option is There is a personal being, a God who created everything. And he sustains everything. And he's a God who can be known, who wants to be known, who has revealed himself in many different ways. And in a world where everything seems to be going off the cliff, going towards death and extinction, this God is one that we can trust. He is our safe place, our refuge, our rock. Everything else is changing. Everything else is fading away. God endures forever. We can put our hope in him. And that's what we're going to see this morning as we look at another psalm, yet another psalm written by David, the great king of Israel. This is Psalm 31. Hopefully you can find it in your own Bible if you brought it. If you're looking at the Bible that we provided, this begins at the very end of page 461 and then continues on page 462. We're going to see something very important today. In a world of danger, a world where people die, a world where people can turn on us, even our friends, our neighbors, and they can hate us and even plot evil against us, a world where we feel like we're wasting away, there is one safe place. And it's not a physical location. It's not something that can be purchased with all the world's money. That safe place is the God who created the universe, who sustains it, and who will bring it to its right end. David put his hope and trust in this God, and we should as well. I'll begin by reading the first five verses, verses 1-5. This is the word of the Lord. To the choir master, a psalm of David. In you, O Lord, do I take refuge. Let me never be put to shame. In your righteousness, deliver me. Incline your ear to me. Rescue me speedily. Be a rock of refuge for me, a strong fortress to save me. For you are my rock and my fortress, and for your name's sake, you lead me and guide me. You take me out of the net they have hidden for me, for you are my refuge. Into your hand I commit my spirit. You have redeemed me, O Lord, faithful God. We don't know exactly what's going on in David's life when he wrote this. It's pretty clear he was in danger. But as I've said repeatedly, in preaching through these psalms, David knew what that was like. At multiple points in his life, he had people who hated him, people who wanted to kill him, who were hunting him down, trying to kill him. People who were hiding a net in which they hoped he would fall so they could trap him. And here David cries out to God as he does, asking for God to save him, to deliver him from his enemies, to not be put to shame, to be defeated by them. Now he knows that God is in control of his life, that God leads him, guides him, and also that God does that for his, God's, own name's sake. God had chosen David for a particular purpose, and David, just as he says in Psalm 23, you lead me in the path of righteousness for your name's sake, God, here. You lead me and you guide me for your name's sake. And it's for God's name's sake because God's reputation is on the line. If David's enemies kill him, if they triumph over him, they'll think David's God is false. Or David was someone deserving to be killed. And then David wouldn't be king, or he wouldn't continue his reign as king. And yet God had chosen David to be king, and he had chosen for one of David's descendants to come later and rule over the world and to bless the world and to do those things forever, to triumph over all evil. So if David doesn't succeed, God doesn't succeed. David doesn't want God's reputation to be marred, to be stained. Well, David further pleads with God in the next three verses, verses 6-8. He says this, I hate those who pay regard to worthless idols, but I trust in the Lord. I will rejoice and be glad in your steadfast love because you have seen my affliction. You have known the distress of my soul, and you have not delivered me into the hand of the enemy. You have set my feet in a broad place. So David says, I trust you, God. But in contrast to that, I hate people who don't trust you. People who instead trust in what he calls worthless idols in this translation. Or the Hebrew, the original language, refers to basically emptiness or vanity. There's one person who translated it as vaporous lies. Empty things. That's what false gods are. That's what idols are. They're not real. They're certainly not gods. They didn't make the universe. They have no power over death. And yet they deceive us. They lie. They promise great things that they can't give us. There are many worthless idols in our age, whether those idols are money, fame, a great career, entertainment, relationships. Sometimes people make a person, a mere human being, whether it's their spouse or boyfriend or girlfriend or a child even, the most important thing. Some people make a leader, that politician, the most important thing, or that, even that pastor sometimes, strange enough, the most important person. But none of those things are God. None of those things can rescue us from death. Those things don't endure. Some of those things are just fleeting pleasures. All those things have a limited value. In a world where death is coming, they cannot save us. They cannot protect us. David knew that. And he says, not only does he hate the worthless idols, not only does he hate the practice of people regarding those worthless idols, he hates the people who trust in those idols. And that might strike us as a bad thing. Or aren't we supposed to never hate? Well, a couple things to say about that. One is it's a poem, and we should keep that in mind, as well as the way that the Hebrew peoples express themselves. When they say hate, sometimes is comparative. Hate, in contrast to something else, means I value this thing more than the thing I hate. So, for example, Jesus tells some people to hate their own family. It doesn't mean hate them in the sense of despise them, wish them harm, or whatever, but it's comparative. Love God even more than your own family. We should also keep in mind that we're told elsewhere in the Psalms, God hates sinners. We've seen that already a couple times. Now, he loves all people, at least in a broad sense. He wants good for them. He provides for them. But he doesn't love them all the same. And there are some people that he loves in that broad way while simultaneously hating them, at least comparatively. So we're told he loved Jacob, but he hated Esau, for example. He preferred Jacob over Esau. God loves it when people love him and trust him. He hates it when people are doing evil, when they're worshiping idols, when they're rejecting him. And that makes sense, by the way. When we talk about sin, it's not just some wrongdoing, but if everything is personal in reality, and if everything is attached to God, directed to God, it's from God, it ultimately comes back to God, everything is personal. Our wrongdoing is a personal affront to God. Our failure to love God is an affront to God. It's a personal rejection of him. Our failure to listen to him, to obey him, to treasure him, it's like a slap in the face. It's deeply personal. David knew that. He viewed his relationship to God as the greatest thing, and he loved that. He loved God. He loved what is right, and because he loved what is right, he hated when people are doing wrong and when they're rejecting God. David also rejoiced in God. He rejoiced when God rescued him. God had rescued him repeatedly in his life. And whatever bad time he was going through when he wrote this, he knew that ultimately God would deliver him. Still, he had those hard times, and he describes them in verses 9 through 13. Be gracious to me, O Lord, for I am in distress. My eye is wasted from grief, my soul and my body also. For my life is spent with sorrow, and my years with sighing. My strength fails because of my iniquity, and my bones waste away. Because of all my adversaries, I have become a reproach, especially to my neighbors, and an object of dread to my acquaintances. Those who see me in the street flee from me. I have been forgotten like one who is dead. I have become like a broken vessel, for I hear the whispering of many, terror on every side, as they scheme together against me, as they plot to take my life. David asks for grace. Get me out of this. Give me the gift of salvation. And he says, this is what I'm going through. Every part of me is wearing away, dissolving, falling apart. His eye was wasted from grief. That sounds kind of funny. But in this way of thinking, the eye is what directs your life. What you're looking at directs your life. You can have a healthy eye by looking at what is good, or you can have an unhealthy eye by looking at what is bad. And David doesn't see hope right now. All he sees is his bad situation, his grief. At least at one point he saw that. He says, my soul, my body, they're wasting away. I'm rotting away. And it's clear that David has two problems. One is his own sin. He says in verse 10, my strength fails because of my iniquity. It's another word for sin. My bones waste away. Doing what is wrong in the moment can often be fun. Some people get a real thrill of doing things that are forbidden, right? There's just like a jolt of something that comes with that. It's like a drug. But in the end, all of that robs us of strength of character. It is felt in our conscience. We know when we've done wrong, and later we, if we're being honest with ourselves, admit how foolish we were. Physically, sin can diminish us. In fact, the reason why we decay and die ultimately is because of sin. God has given us a partial punishment for our sin, and that is death. And death came into the world because the first human beings, Adam and Eve, didn't trust God and obey him as they ought to have done. They thought they knew better than God. And as a result, God says, you can't live forever in this state of rebellion. You will die. And death is like a cancer that eats everything in its path. It's like an enemy that is hunting us down. And wherever we turn, there's no safety. There's no escape. David knew that he had sinned against God. And he realized that he was in this predicament, at least in part, because of his own sin. But he also had another problem. There's external enemies, not just the enemy within his sin, but there are these people who were plotting evil against him. And because of them, he had become a reproach. His name had become like a criticism, a taunt. Like, here's that loser, David. He was in such a bad state, no one wanted anything to do with him. His neighbors, acquaintances, they flee. In fact, the language that's used there, it's very similar to the language that we find in the book of Job. Job was this righteous man, but he suffered greatly, suffered great personal loss. He had this terrible disease in his skin. And then what happens? His friends come and start reproaching him. David felt like he would die and be forgotten, like someone who was already died and forgotten, like a broken vessel. And again, in a world where there's no God, everything will die and everything will be forgotten in the end. But even in the midst of all this darkness and this pain, this distress, David expresses confidence in God, and he speaks of God's goodness. We find that in verses 14 through 22. I'll read all these now. But I trust in you, O Lord. I say, you are my God. My times are in your hand. Rescue me from the hand of my enemies and from my persecutors. Make your face shine on your servant. Save me in your steadfast love. O Lord, let me not be put to shame, for I call upon you. Let the wicked be put to shame. Let them go silently to Sheol. Let the lying lips be mute which speak insolently against the righteous in pride and contempt. Oh, how abundant is your goodness, which you have stored up for those who fear you and worked for those who take refuge in you in the sight of the children of mankind. In the cover of your presence, you hide them from the plots of men. You store them in your shelter from the strife of tongues. Blessed be the Lord, for he has wondrously shown his steadfast love to me. When I was in a besieged city, I had said in my alarm, I am cut off from your sight. But you heard the voice of my pleas for mercy when I cried to you for help. There are a few important things to see in those verses. The first is that David reaffirms his trust in God. He was going through that moment of distress, but he says, still, I trust in you, God, and you are my God. You're my king. You're my master. I'm yours. And even says, my times are in your hand. And I think that at the least that would mean David knew that when he lived was up to God. God had determined that. And even that God had determined when he would die, the length of his life, how much time I have on earth. It's up to you. It's in your hand. My life is in your hand. But I think even he would say that he knew ultimately all the events of his life were in God's control. They were planned by God. It's all yours, God. My life is in your hands, and I trust that you will bring me to a very good end. I know that you protect those who take refuge in you. I know that you hear my cries for help, God. And that's the second thing. He's crying for God's help. He knew God was in control, but that didn't keep him from praying. And he says what? Shine your face on your servant. He echoes that famous benediction of Numbers 6. The Lord make his face to shine upon you. To have God's face shine upon you is for God to see you, to know you, to regard you, to care for you, to bless you. David again asked for deliverance. Not only that, he says, you silence those wicked people. I want you to shut up those lying lips. David wants justice. He wants God to put an end to evil. And the third thing is, David says, there was a time when I felt like a besieged city. I was surrounded by enemies. There was no way out, and I panicked. And so in my alarm, in verse 22, he says, I said, I am cut off from your sight. In that moment, I felt like, God, I was cut off from you, like you abandoned me or you rejected me. And in our moments of darkness, whatever those are, whether it's because of some physical ailment, a disease, a condition, whether it's because someone around us has died, someone we love, whether we're just depressed or maybe we're thinking about our own sins, the things that we've done wrong, and we can't see anything beyond that. We may think that God has rejected us, cut us off, given us over to what we deserve. Or we might think that God just isn't even real. None of this is right. Maybe we think God is real, but we're just getting what we deserve. He's punishing us. Whatever it is that we're going through and feeling, in these times, we must remember what this is really about in the end, what this psalm is about, just as what all passages of Scripture ultimately are about, and that is Jesus. You know, earlier I said we have a choice before us. The choice is whether you're going to believe in an impersonal, cold universe, an accident, or a personal universe of some kind. Now, some people get this confused. They think, well, I want a personal universe, therefore the universe is God. That's pantheism. All pan is God. Theism. It's kind of a strange thing when you think about it. You have to say, well, this cancer is God. Or this virus is God. Others think that, well, maybe the universe isn't God itself, but God dwells in the universe the way that my soul is in my body. It's called panentheism. All in God, or God is in all. So, you know, God is in this wood, and God is in the rock outside, and God is in each one of us. Others may think there's a God. He's not the universe. He's not in the universe in that way, but he's a God who just made everything, and then he kind of has a hands-off approach to the universe. That's the God of deism, a God who winds the clock up, creates the clock, winds it up, lets it go, and adios. Well, all of those views come very short of the true God, the one who is described in the pages of the Bible. Indeed, God is not the universe, and the universe isn't his body, though he is present in some way in all the universe. And he's intimately involved in the universe. He doesn't just wind it up and let it go. He is continually sustaining it at every moment. And he's a God who wants to be known, who wants to have a relationship with us, who wants us to value and cherish and love him and serve him. And it makes sense that if a God is like that, there would be some point in time where he reveals himself in a way that we could see, some kind of visible, tangible form. And that's what he did in Jesus. In fact, we believe that God is not just a personal God, he's tri-personal. He's three persons. One God, three persons. And that means that there have always been the Father, the Son, and the Spirit. These three persons are always in relationship with each other, loving each other. So love is at the root of the universe. They're eternal, these three persons, Father, Son, and Spirit. They all have no beginning. They all have divine power. They all act in concert. They all have the same will, the same plan. They create the universe. They sustain the universe. And yet, over 2,000 years ago, one of them, the Son of God, became a human being. We know him as Jesus. And he came to earth to reveal most clearly who God is, what he is like, what he wants of us. He came also to fulfill God's designs for humanity, to live the perfect life, the one that we don't. But he also came to pay the penalty for our sins, to die in place of sinners. Though he never sinned, he allowed the iniquity of others to rob him of strength. People who hated him plotted against him. His body wasted away. He died. And yet he rose from the grave. God delivered him. God vindicated him. He suffered tremendously for us. His body falling apart and dying. He experienced condemnation on our behalf. And yet God brought him up out of the pit. And Jesus' resurrection shows that he is God, that he has power over sin and death, and that one day all his people will rise from the grave in bodies that can never die. In the end, the only safe place is Jesus. And he's safe because he's good. He's perfect. He is safe because he is eternal. He will never disappear or go out of existence. He is safe because he's all-powerful. He has the ability to protect us and to sustain our lives forever. He is safe because he is so good and caring and loving and protecting that he would even die for us. I was thinking about the importance of a personal being being our safe place. And strangely, this is going to be strange, I'm trying to think of some analogy. And this is what came to mind, because my mind's kind of strange. I don't know how many of you have seen any of the Terminator movies. But if you've seen one or seen them all, I think I've seen five of six. There's six of them. Yeah, it's crazy. In all of the movies, at some point, one of the characters says this exact line or some variation of it. Come with me if you want to live. The good guy says that, right? And here's the whole Terminator movies. They're dark, they're violent, they're not appropriate for kids. There's a Terminator, some kind of cyborg, killer robot sent from the future to kill someone. A destruction machine that cannot be stopped, it seems. Can't be stopped easily. They're overpowering. And there's also a good guy sent from the future to protect from the Terminator. And the good guy says, come with me if you want to live, to the person they're trying to save. And they say that because there's no hiding from the Terminator. The Terminator is programmed to kill this one person. And the Terminator is super strong. It can take all kinds of bullets and bombs that come its way. In the second Terminator movie, the Terminator can be like blown up and destroyed and then reform and keep going. Scary. There's no place you can hide. You can't go into the police station and be safe. You can't hide in a bank vault and be safe. There's no amount of money that you could use to stop the Terminator, to buy him out so that he wouldn't come and kill you. The only safe place is to go to the person who can protect you and stay with him till you get to safety. Death is a lot like the Terminator. There's no way that we can run from it and go to some place on earth, some building, some temple. There's no amount of money that you can use to buy off death. There's no mere human being, a politician, your loved one, who can conquer death for you. The only one who has the power to stop death, who conquered it, and who will come and destroy it, is Jesus. And he's the only one who can take away your sins, which is the reason why we're decaying and dying and wasting away. And so I say to us simply, don't waste your life. Let us not waste the time that we have. Trust in Jesus. In the end, those who trust in him will be safe. Those who reject him will be destroyed. This Jesus, who went through hell and back to save us, trusted in God all the way. He is the one who said, into your hands I commit my spirit, as he was dying on the cross. He died for us, and there's no other option. You believe there's no God, you're just going to die and rot. There's nothing for you. You believe in some vague notion of a God. Who is that? What's he like? But if you believe in this God, you must turn to Jesus. No one else has the words of life. No one else can give us hope. I'll close with the final verses of this psalm, verses 23 and 24. Love the Lord, all you his saints. The Lord preserves the faithful, but abundantly repays the one who acts in pride. Be strong and let your heart take courage, all you who wait for the Lord. Let's pray. Father, in a world where much doesn't make sense to us, a world that sometimes doesn't feel very hopeful, a world where death is a reality that seems to hunt us all down and destroy everything, there is hope, there is safety, and it is you. You are that rock of refuge, that fortress in whom we can trust. And there is no one else. You, your Son, your Spirit are our safety. Jesus is the one that we must come to and trust. Our shelter in a storm. A firm foundation. Everything else will vanish. Everything else will fade away. Everything else is a worthless idol. A lying vanity. A vapor, a mist. I pray that we would see that and we would live accordingly, that we would praise you in all things, that we would trust you through all things, that in all our trials and our distress, we would cry out to you, that when you give us moments of rest and moments of getting us out of certain little pits that we're in, we would declare your excellency and speak of your goodness, that we would look forward to the day when we will be raised from the grave in bodies that can never die. Help us not to panic and say, there is no God, or he has cut us off, but help us to trust in you always. You are safe, God, the safest one we can trust. I pray this in Jesus' name.